Welcome to Food for Thought, the place to explore, celebrate, and manifest a life motivated and defined by unconditional compassion and optimal wellness. Today's episode is Jim Crow and Zip Coon, Animals and Racial Stereotypes. Before we begin, hi everyone, my name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com on social media, and you can find my books wherever books are sold. I look forward to having you join me in one of my online cooking classes or on one of our upcoming vegan trips around the world, Europe, Africa, Asia, just pick. Food for Thought is in its 15th year because of the support of listeners like you. I honestly could not do this work without you. You are the reason I'm able to do this work. I don't have sponsors or advertisers. I have you. So please consider joining other supporters by going to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGoudreau to become a supporter at your chosen level. If every single person who downloaded this episode, this podcast in general, supported this podcast, I would never have to ask again. So thank you so much in advance for supporting it, for subscribing to it, for listening to it, for sharing it, and for leaving ratings and reviews. Jim Crow has become such a familiar term, as in Jim Crow laws, or the Jim Crow South, or the Jim Crow era, that it's easy to miss the animal, in this case, the crow, inside the phrase. Who was Jim Crow? Was he a real person? How did the crow come to be associated with a repressive system of violent, discriminatory, and racist laws that hindered and harmed Black men and women for decades after the Civil War, during and after Reconstruction? What do crows have to do with this appalling era of American history we call the Jim Crow era? Or was crow just an arbitrarily chosen surname having nothing to do with the bird? What is the story behind this animology? Now, if you're listening for the first time and don't know what the heck I'm talking about when I say animology, it's a term I coined to refer to the animal-related words and expressions we use every day and how they affect and reflect our regard for, our thinking about, and our treatment of other animals, including human animals. We have thousands of animologies in our English language, and many, in fact, have to do with crows, ravens, and jays, some of the species of birds in the corvid family, my favorite family of birds, if I do say so myself. I don't know if you have a favorite family of birds, but corvids are my favorite. And we will cover those animologies in another episode. But here are just a few corvid-related animologies, expressions such as crow's feet, as in the wrinkles around our eyes as we get older, as the crow flies, to describe the most direct route between two points, stone the crows, as in an expression of shock or surprise, to crow about something, meaning to brag about something, to rook, meaning to swindle or cheat, comes from rook, the bird, and words such as jaywalk, to cross or walk across the street without regard for approaching traffic. To be ravenous is to be extremely hungry. Corbel, which is a projection jutting out from a wall to support a structure above it. Coracoid, which is a short projection from the shoulder blade in mammals to which part of the biceps is attached, and more. So stay tuned for that episode. And of course, if you're interested in more animologies, you can go listen to Animology Podcasts. I am not continuing to add new episodes, but of course you can listen to the ones I've already done. And if you haven't listened to Animology, my TED talk called Animology, then you can do so over at YouTube. Now, many animologies are positive, some are negative, and some just simply relate to the characteristics of the animals, which brings us to Jim Crow. Jim Crow, who was not a real person, was a fictional character whose exact origins are somewhat fuzzy, but here's what we can piece together. You're probably most familiar with Jim Crow as the name for that codified system of racial apartheid, of state and local laws that enforced racial segregation and disenfranchisement in the southern United States during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Before that, Jim Crow was simultaneously a derogatory and offensive name for a black person, and also the name of a stage character of song and dance first performed by Thomas Rice in the 1830s, and subsequently by other actors, both on stage and on screen, dressed as blackface minstrels. We'll talk more about that. Before that, it was the name of an early 19th century plantation song of the American South, sung by black slaves, likely based on a Crow character named Jim in an old West African folktale. In the Yoruba culture of Western Africa, what is now the countries of Nigeria, Benin, and Togo, there is a folktale about Jim, a clever crow who acts foolish to get what he wants. Now, many cultures have tales of the trickster. It's an archetypal character who exhibits a great deal of intellect or secret knowledge and uses it to play tricks or otherwise disobey normal rules and defy conventional behavior. The most common trickster figure is coyote, but raven, crow, blue jay, rabbit, spider, raccoon, bear, and others appear in trickster myths in many different cultures. Now, African cultural traditions include many folk tales of trickster animals. Brer Rabbit is probably the most well-known. It's a central figure in an oral tradition passed down by African Americans of the Southern United States. And the slave trade most certainly brought these folk tales to America with the slaves who were captured and sold. And Jim Crow was apparently a favorite and would have had positive connotations for the men and women who knew and shared these stories in general and that story in particular. From there, the stories of Jim Crow, a clever trickster who overcomes his travails by his wits rather than by brawn, provoking authority figures and bending social mores as he sees fit, turned into songs. These stories turned into songs that would have been heard and sung and passed around in the fields and in the slave quarters on plantations. And separately, African Americans, both enslaved and free, would have told among themselves these folk tales in which animal characters tricked their way to triumph, disrupting the balance of power. In these tales, roosters chased foxes and goats terrorized lions and Brer Rabbit taunted wolf and crows stood up to bullying bullfrogs. Blacks on islands across the Caribbean and along the Carolina coast sang a song, Jump Jim Crow. And it was exactly this subversive song, a subversive character, a subversive story telling of a trickster animal who prevails despite all the odds being against him. Now, some slaves even adopted a Jim Crow type attitude as a way of coping with their enslavement. They would play dumb or act the fool as a way of getting by. And of course, they sang and they danced. If you haven't read Frederick Douglass's memoirs of the songs sung by slaves, I highly recommend reading this memoir, of course, but he talks about the songs being the most heartbreaking aspect of his experience in slavery, in that you hear the songs and you think they're songs of joy, and really they're songs of just absolute sorrow, and they're songs of coping. These are coping mechanisms. And same with dancing. And as if being in bondage wasn't enough, laws were passed in the 1600s that prohibited slaves from performing their native dances. Whites believed the slave way of dancing formed a cross with their feet, something they considered blasphemous. According to a website called Blackface, in order to evade the law, slaves developed a shuffle dance where their feet didn't cross, and they called the dance the Jim Crow. Enter Thomas D. Rice, Thomas Dartmouth Rice, or Daddy Rice, as he came to be called. He was a white traveling performer and playwright from New York who in the early 19th century appropriated this trickster character and created a new genre, the minstrel show, a popular form of racist entertainment whereby white men dressed up in blackface lampooned black men and women. They depicted them as lazy, dim, buffoonish, and happy-go-lucky despite their plight. Now, I want to make sure that it's clear when I say minstrel show, the word minstrel originally just referred to a musician in general, but it came to be referred to specifically this performance, this blackface performance over time. But minstrel just in general, of course, is just a, you know, if you look at medieval minstrels, they were mostly harp players and string instrument players and went around the countryside and sang songs. And it became a word that referred to this blackface performance. Now, according to one story, Thomas Rice traveled to the southern United States looking for fresh ideas for his stage shows, and that's where he discovered slaves singing a song about a legendary man named Jim Crow. Another story is that he happened upon a black man, possibly an old black slave, possibly a ragged young stable boy, singing an old plantation song about Jim Crow, and he was intrigued. Whatever it was that sparked his imagination, he was inspired to create this caricature we now know today as Jim Crow. He dressed in shabby clothes, he took on this crooked posture, he painted his face black using burnt cork, he sang his own adaptation of slave music in general, and this song in particular, and he took his show on the road. And it became a huge success, and he became very wealthy, and the minstrel show was born. Now, Rice debuted this stereotypical blackface character, Jim Crow, in 1828, and it attained national popularity by 1832. It took him from Louisville to Cincinnati to Pittsburgh to Philadelphia to New York, even to London and Dublin and Paris. His show was a huge hit with white audiences who relished the portrayals of blacks as singing, dancing, grinning fools. And Rice just became hugely popular. He became famous from this. Now, you can go on YouTube and you can find some of this music. You can go on Google and just find the lyrics to the song Jump Jim Crow. And there are lots of minstrel shows that follow that. I'll let you do that on your own. Suffice it to say, Rice was not the first comic to perform in blackface, but he was the most popular of his time, and he inspired many imitators. There's a really fantastic online resource I really recommend you check out called the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, curated by Ferris State University in Michigan. And this is what they said about that. In 1843, this is about the imitators of Thomas Rice. In 1843, four white men from New York, billed as the Virginia Minstrels, darkened their faces and imitated the singing and dancing of blacks. They used violins, castanets, banjos, bones, and tambourines. In 1845, the Christie Minstrels originated many features of the minstrel show, including the seating of the blackface performers in a semicircle on stage with the tambourine player, Mr. Tambo, at one end, and the bones player, Mr. Bones, at the other, the singing of songs called Ethiopian melodies with harmonized choruses and the humorous banter of jokes between the end men and the performer in the middle seat, Mr. Interlocutor. These performers were sometimes called Ethiopian delineators, and the shows were popularly referred to as coon shows, the etymological name of which we will get to soon. Now, there's no doubt that Jim Crow was in the tradition of the crow, trickster, the clever, charismatic character, one that undermined both racism and slavery. And that's exactly why black slaves would have embraced him. In his book, Jump Jim Crow, Lost Plays, Lyrics, and Street Prose of the First Atlantic Popular Culture, author W.T. Lamon Jr. notes that in Thomas Dartmouth Rice's sketches and songs, Jim Crow always outwits his white superiors. And while that's true, Rice appropriated a character that would have been a hero to blacks and made him something that became grotesque. It became grotesque mostly from the imitators that followed. They less reflected Rice's subversive persona, argues Lahman, but rather perpetrated condescending stereotypes, overacting in ludicrous, you know, Negro dialect, as it would have been called, and dancing in sketches that often revolved around life among an imaginary plantation, plantation slaves. Rice and his imitators, said again by the Jim Crow Museum, by their stereotypical depictions of blacks, helped to popularize the belief that blacks were lazy, stupid, inherently less human, animal-like, and unworthy of integration. Right? During the years that blacks were being victimized by lynch mobs, they were also victimized by the racist caricatures propagated through novels, sheet music, theatrical plays, and minstrel shows. Ironically, this is still the quote from the Jim Crow Museum. Ironically, years later, when blacks replaced white minstrels, the blacks also blackened their faces, thereby pretending to be whites, pretending to be blacks. Now, the Jim Crow Museum has some pretty amazing, I mean, they are the Museum of Racist Memorabilia. You can imagine they have some pretty amazing memorabilia you can see on their website, including clips from minstrel performances and the video they have on their website. One of the videos they have on their website features Jump Jim Crow. And I'll include a link to it from my website so you can see what we're talking about here. From Jim Crow, other blackface characters appeared. As I said, these imitators in terms of the performers, but characters, not just Jim Crow, appeared. Beyond Jim Crow, you had the Sambos. These were all in minstrel shows. Coons and dandies. And from these general stock characters, you have characters called Jim Dandy and one particular character called Zip Coon. And you have shows called Coon Shows. And so before we move on to how Jim Crow came to be a racial slur, as well as a name for segregationist laws, I want to first turn to another animal-related pejorative, coon. Now, coon, just a shortened version of raccoon, was not originally a racist slur. You have coon skin by the early 1800s, unfortunately referring to the skin of a raccoon who's been hunted and or trapped and then skinned. So you have coon skin. You have coon dog in the early 1800s, referring to a dog that's good at hunting raccoons, right? Coon dog. And around that time in the 1830s, coon came to mean someone who's sly, someone who's clever but sly, a little duplicitous, referring to the animal who crept low to the ground. So someone who crept low to the ground like a raccoon. So by that time, you have this word that describes someone who is duplicitous. It's an adjective. And then around this time, it very quickly becomes an offensive racist slur against black people. By the 1830s, for sure. At least in written documentation, which means it would have been spoken prior to that. So by 1830s, for sure, most definitely spurred on by the blackface minstrel character Zip Coon, which was popularized by minstrel performer George Washington Dixon. He was a contemporary, probably a rival, of Thomas Rice's character Jim Crow. Now, in early minstrel songs, the coon was indeed a reference to a raccoon, the animal. So when you hear coon in a song, it's not necessarily a racist slur. It could very well be referring to a raccoon. But soon, the coon caricature became one of the stock characters among minstrel performers. And minstrel show audiences would laugh at the slow-talking fool who avoided work, who avoided adult responsibilities, and this transformed the coon into a comic figure, a source of bitter and vulgar comic relief. He was called Zip Coon. He was sometimes called Urban Coon. And as with Sambo, says the Jim Crow Museum, the coon was portrayed as a lazy, easily frightened, chronically idle, inarticulate buffoon. The coon differed, and they actually talk about the difference in terms of the character, the Sambo character and the coon character. They talk about the difference between the two. The coon, the Sambo was predicted as a perpetual child. right? Not capable of living as an independent adult. The coon acted childish, but he was an adult, right? But he was a good-for-nothing adult. Sambo was portrayed as a loyal and contented servant, that stereotype that so many of us have seen on screen. The coon, although he often worked as a servant, wasn't happy with his status. He was just too lazy, too cynical to change his lowly position. And so you have a flood of these coon songs that poured into the popular repertoire in the post-Civil War Reconstruction era, with titles such as The Dandy Coons Parade. So again, you've got that Dandy, the Jim Dandy character. So The Dandy Coons Parade, you could even see right there, it's a mockery. Or Oh, Mr. Coon, and then The Coons Are on Parade. In vaudeville, coon songs also flourished, and white females became the deliverers of these coon songs. They were called coon shouters. And foremost among the coon shouters, there was a woman named May Irwin. There is a song it is so disgustingly horrific to read some of the lyrics of some of these songs. And this is what I mean when I say this got way far away from the original Jim Crow character. And if you want to read, no one wants to read it, but to know our history and to know what is true, you can read the lyrics of a song called The Bully Song from 1896. There are a lot of ugly songs to choose from. This is probably the most offensive, horrifically racist lyrics I've ever read. I always say that, just when you think you've hit bottom, you realize you can always go lower. And they did. These composers did. And sadly, even black songwriters produce songs as fully demeaning of their own people as those by white composers. The worst of these is one called All Coons Look Alike to Me by one Ernest Hogan. And the most prolific of the black composers to join in was Bob Cole, who wrote dozens of songs such as No Coons Allowed and I Wonder What the Coons Game Is. Of course, you can see all of this on the Jim Crow Museum online. So while the minstrel stage shows were popular between 1850 and 1870, they lost much of their national popularity with the coming of motion pictures and radios and then eventually television. Unfortunately, the minstrel shows continued in small towns and caricatured portrayals of blacks found greater expression in motion pictures and radios. Early Hollywood films capitalized on this stereotype, with the first cinematic coon appearing in Wooing and Wedding of a Coon, 1905, a staggeringly racist portrayal of two dim-witted and, these buffoons. They're just made to be buffoons. And of course, the prototypical movie coon was Stepin Fetchit. I'm sure you've heard that name, the slow-talking, slow-walking, self-demeaning character, Stepin Fetchit. So by 1838, the terms coon and Jim Crow were being used as a collective racial epithet for blacks, and the popularity of minstrel shows clearly aided the spread of both as a racial slur. Now, coon would still be recognized as a racial slur today. I'm not sure Jim Crow would be recognized as a racist term today, right? We think about, when we hear Jim Crow, we think about the segregationist laws. We don't think about it as a racist term. I think most of us don't. It did exist as a racist term really only for about a half a century. But at the time, to call someone Jim Crow wasn't just to call attention to their skin color, wasn't just to say that they're black. It was to reduce that person to the kind of caricature that Rice performed on stage. And then, of course, that became popularized by all of the imitators. So now you can see how this term then, by the end of the 19th century, was less likely to derisively describe blacks. Instead, it evolved to describe laws and customs that oppressed blacks. All right, and that's how the phrase Jim Crow came to refer to anti-black laws laid down after Reconstruction and to the racial hierarchy that defined American life through these set of laws and practices, which operated primarily but not exclusively in southern and border states between 1877 and the mid-1960s. essentially ending when Lyndon Johnson signs the Voting Rights Act in 1964. Some of the most common Jim Crow laws included restrictions on voting rights. Many Southern states required literacy tests or limited voting to those whose grandfathers had also the right to vote. Bans on interracial relationships and clauses that allowed businesses to separate their black and white clientele. By the way, you can hear more about black voter suppression in a Food for Thought podcast episode called Pig Laws and Black Codes. And of course, voter suppression is alive and well today. The segregationist philosophy of separate but equal was later upheld in the famous 1896 Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, in which the court ruled that the state of Louisiana had the right to require different railroad cars for blacks and whites. The Plessy decision would eventually lead to widespread adoption of segregated restaurants, public bathrooms, water fountains, and other facilities. Separate but equal was eventually overturned in the 1954 Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education. But Jim Crow's legacy would continue to endure in some Southern states after Johnson signed the law well into the 1970s. Throughout this Jim Crow era, the word crow itself became a racial slur, and black men and women were frequently caricatured as black birds and crows in musicals and stories, songs, and films. Now, it's possible this came about because of the connection to the history of the character Jim Crow and its subsequent pejorative connotations. It's possible it's simply because of the color of the birds. I mean, it's one of the theories that, you know, black crows, and they became these caricatures of black men and women. But however it came to be negative to be called crow, for many slaves who were sold into slavery from Western Africa, brought to the United States, the crow had positive connotations. He was a symbol of good luck, and the wily trickster crow, Jim, who became Jim Crow, was a character slaves could relate to, a small way to feel empowered, emboldened, a mirror in which they could see themselves reflected, right? This character that subverts the norms and really undermines the racist world they're living in. But that character became appropriated and perverted, and crow became a racist epithet, joining the legion of other animal-related pejoratives that only work because of our collective understanding, our collective belief that animals are inferior to human animals. The only reason calling a human being an animal, any animal, as a way to demean and dehumanize them is because animals are the lowest of the low in terms of power and perception in our society. That's why all you have to do is say you're a rat, he's a monkey, she's a pig, for it to be an insult. Coon, crow, right, whatever it is. Out of context, they're just names for the animals. In context, they're pejoratives. In my erstwhile podcast called Animology, and in my TEDx talk called Animology, Change Your Language About Animals, Change the World, I talk not only about how animologies reflect our connection to, as well as our animosity towards other animals, and how we wield animologies against fellow humans when we want to degrade them most. This is an excerpt from the TEDx talk to frame this entire conversation about crows and Jim Crow. We know that in order to hurt or kill fellow human beings in war or any act of violence, first you have to dehumanize them, to create a psychological distance from them that enables you to justify hurting or killing them. And the quickest and most effective way to lower the status of a human is to call them an animal. This is not just semantics. Using derogatory animal words to discriminate against fellow humans has enabled us to commit the worst atrocities in human history, systematically depicting Native Americans as hogs, dogs, and wolves, laid the foundation for the near annihilation of the indigenous peoples of North America, systematically characterizing Jews as rats, pigs, and worms. The Nazis laid the groundwork for the murder of over 6 million people. The Hutus systematically depicting the Tutsis as insects and cockroaches created the fertile ground for the Rwandan genocide, and systematically calling people of color apes, monkeys, and baboons, and I would add crows, laid the foundation for systemic racism and chattel slavery in the United States. And while it makes us uncomfortable to hear these depictions of various human groups, they rest upon stereotypes of animals, which are false in their own right, as if pigs are inherently disgusting, as if rats are naturally devious, as if wolves are brutal and vicious, as if crows are villainous and criminal and harbingers of evil. They're not. But our perceived human superiority dictates that we portray them as such. And yet, if we were to characterize these animals based not on our own biases, but rather on what we actually know to be true about the cognitive, emotional, and social lives of these animals, it would be an entirely different story. After all, pigs are intelligent, playful, and fastidiously clean. Rats are social, adaptable, and resourceful. Cockroaches are survivors. Monkeys are family-oriented. Crows are crafty, clever, resourceful, and highly intelligent, characteristics we admire, characteristics we all share. Human and non-human animal alike, we share the fundamental aspects of eating and drinking, working and playing, fighting and loving, birthing and dying, living and breathing. We are all animals. But because we don't embrace that fact, we dehumanize humans by calling them animals. And we demean animals by making the animals themselves insults, creating a cycle of violence against human and non-human that will continue until we can learn to distinguish between differences and deficiencies. May that day come sooner rather than later, and may we all be part of that evolution by being mindful of the words we use and the words we choose and how we depict one another and how we treat one another and how we think about one another and how we talk about one another and how we talk to one another. For the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thank you for helping to change the way we talk and think about animals, both human and non-human.